Welcome to KLOI FM 102.9 and Lopez Writers Read, the program that introduces listeners to writers from Lopez Island and sometimes from beyond. I'm Iris Gravel, and I'm guest host for today's edition. The show's usual host, Lorna Reese, invited me to interview an off-island writer, Anna Maria Spagna. Lorna is here in the studio managing the recording controls so that the program can be aired at a later time and also archived so people can listen to it whenever and wherever they want. This is just another example of the many ways that Lorna, herself a skilled writer, serves as a midwife and doula for the Lopez writing community. Thank you, Lorna, for all that you do to support writers. It's a particular pleasure for me to introduce our listeners to today's guest, Anna Maria Spagna. I've known Anna Maria for years as a friend, teacher, and writer whose books and stories I admire. Today I'll be talking with her about her new book, Test Ride on the Sunnyland Bus, A Daughter's Civil Rights Journey, as well as about her life as a writer. Welcome, Anna Maria.
Thank you so much for having me, Iris. It's a delight to be here.
And welcome to Lopez Island. We're delighted you've included a stop here as part of your book tour for Test Ride on the Sunnyland Bus. Our listeners will be hearing this program after your reading tonight at Lopez Library, which is May 22nd. Anna Maria, this is your first visit to Lopez, but I know it must feel somewhat reminiscent of your home. Tell us a bit about your life in Stehekin, Washington.
Well, Stehekin is a very small community, only about 100 year-round people, at the north end of Lake Chelan in the center of the state. So you have to take a ferry to get there, even though it's not an island. It's landlocked, very similar to Lopez that way, and similar in that it's forested, and similar that it's a tight community, similar in a lot of ways. It feels very comfortable to be here.
Oh, great. And your first book, Now Go Home, is set in Stehekin, right?
Well, largely it is. It's set in various places where I worked on trail crews for the National Park Service and the U.S. Forest Service over a period of 14 years. And that meant living seasonally, which I'm sure listeners on Lopez are familiar with, working when there was work in the summertime and getting by as well as I could in the wintertime.
Well, Now Go Home is a wise and candid book of essays about Anna Maria's journey from the suburbs of Los Angeles to college in Oregon and eventually to working on a trail crew, as she said, in the North Cascades and settling in Stehekin. And I highly recommend that book to you as well. And now you have a second book, Test Ride on the Sunnyland Bus, A Daughter's Civil Rights Journey. Congratulations on its publication and its selection as a winner of the River Teeth Literary Nonfiction Prize.
Thank you very much.
After your first book about life in Stehekin, what prompted you to tell this story?
Well, the story began the way a lot of good stories begin, with wasting time. I was sitting at my desk, and I was supposed to be either teaching or writing, and instead I was Googling my younger brother's name. And Joey's a spider biologist, so a couple articles on spiders popped up, and then a book by the name of Inside Agitators, Southern Whites and the Civil Rights Movement popped up. Well, that couldn't be Joey. Joey's younger than I am. That had to be our dad, and it just sparked my interest, and from there I began following the thread of my father's involvement in the early civil rights movement.
Wow, that's fascinating. For all of us who worry about that we are, in fact, wasting time on the computer and the internet. I don't know, you may have just blown that as a concern. Anna Maria, your writing in Test Ride is skillful and heartfelt, and it's multi-layered with your father's story, your own journey, and your mother's experience with cancer. You also sprinkle in humor, history, and a good bit of contrast between your life and that of the people your dad worked with in the civil rights movement. What do you hope readers will take from Test Ride?
The story is a story about courage and the many forms that courage takes. From my dad's courageous stand in Tallahassee in 1957, where he tried to integrate a city bus, to my mother, who raised us alone for 30 years after my father died young, to the kind of everyday courage of people living their lives the best way that they know how.
And we can certainly use some more stories of courage. I appreciate you having the courage to bring it to us. Will you read something for us from Test Ride?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to start by reading a little bit from Chapter 1 that just gives you a little bit of the context of the historical tale that's at the center of the story. My dad was involved in the Tallahassee bus boycott, and I'll start there. Mm-hmm. Though the Tallahassee boycott is less well known than the one in Montgomery, Alabama, the one Rosa Parks started and Martin Luther King led, it took place at exactly the same time and seemed at first to be equally successful. A group of black citizens led by the grocer Dan Speed and the charismatic Reverend C.K. Steele organized mass meetings and funded a clandestine carpool. As in Montgomery, the bus company suffered, long-standing discrimination was exposed, and victory seemed within reach. Then in December, the U.S. Supreme Court issued the order to integrate buses in Montgomery, and in Tallahassee, all hell broke loose. The holiday season turned violent, crosses were burned on church lawns, gunfire broke out nightly, bomb threats accrued. 2 days after Christmas, Dan Speed and C.K. Steele and a dozen other ministers met for a planned integrated bus ride, a celebration of sorts of that victory in Montgomery. But they were met at the downtown depot by a mob wielding barely concealed weapons. "I detected how tense the situation was," Steele later said. "There were men from out of town, and most of these were, I guess, Ku Klux Klansmen buying up hatchets and hammers and carrying them around. They called the ride off right then and there." Soon, the city council drafted a new ordinance to maintain segregation in Tallahassee at all costs, and for all intents and purposes, the bus boycott was dead. So Steele called a mass meeting at his church, Bethel Missionary Baptist. The violence had scared off most supporters. The few who lined the wooden pews that January night were the stalwarts, the true believers, and to them, Steele made an impassioned plea. They needed volunteers, both blacks and whites, he explained, to ride a bus together and test the bogus new ordinance. Was anyone willing? The room fell silent. My father stood. He'd been one of a small handful of white students who'd been attending the mass meetings. "I think I can serve as one of the persons," he said.
Thank you. That does give us a... an idea of lots of things to come in this story. And I know from having read the book more than once that there were lots of adventures and misadventures and trials and tribulations for you to get to the point that you could piece together what you just read.
Right, even to write something like that, which sounds like straight history, took pretty much 2 full years of research and interviews and spending time in archives to try to figure out what was the basic story, what was the plot at work. And so that very first chapter was the hardest chapter to write, the one that just summarizes the basics so we can get started on the journey.
And yet summarizes it in a way that is so interesting and compelling and draws the reader in. And for people like me who was really pretty sheltered from that whole experience, it's like a history lesson, a much needed history lesson.
Well, it certainly was for me. I went into the research thinking that, you know, I knew about the civil rights movement. I'm an educated person. And once you start hearing these stories and hearing the real details of how much danger they face and how much courage people had and how much they sacrificed, it's humbling. It's humbling and inspiring, but it is at first so very humbling. Mm-hmm. And just to get those stories out to people would make the whole project worth it to me.
Well, again, we're indebted to you for getting those stories out, because they are, many of them are untold stories, and that comes out in your book as well. I want to talk a little now about you as a writer, and in addition to this particular book, your writing in general. Many writers, especially of memoir, talk about learning things during the writing process that they didn't know before. What surprises or what things did you encounter writing Test Ride? I know you learned a lot about your dad and his involvement and about this whole time in history, but on a more personal note, what surprises for yourself?
I think that I hadn't realized how reluctant I was to see my father in a heroic light in many ways, even to think much about him. My dad died pretty tragically when I was 11 years old. He went out jogging and didn't come back. And we had been jogging together a lot at that time in his life. I don't think I realized the depth of the guilt that I carried about his death, or my resistance to getting close to the memory of him. At one point in my research, I was still in that early stage where you think, oh, this is a project that's separate from me. This is a story I'm going to tell that's not involving me. And I sat down in an archive with a beautiful cherry wood table, and they brought me a stack of testimony where my dad had testified before a committee in Florida. I turned the page, and there's your father. He's 25 years old. Those are his words. That's him alive on the page. I had to close it and kind of compose myself for a minute and realize how close I was and how actually my relationship with my father was now maturing 30 years after he was gone.
Wow. And I would bet that that was something there. I don't know how else you would have learned that other than doing this book.
I don't know that I would have. I don't know that I almost had to take this sideways path into it, I think, as so many things in life are. I didn't often talk to people about stories about my dad. And an interesting thing about doing this research, too, is that I thought, well, after I'd been into it, I'm getting to know my dad because I never did, because I didn't have him. But over and over, as I go and read the story and share it, people whose fathers lived their whole lives say, I'm so jealous because I got to know him before I was born. You get to know your father as a young man, as a 25-year-old, and it's a real blessing just on a personal level to get that close to him.
So without giving away too much from the book, in this getting to know your dad, did you get to know him as a real person, or is this heroic figure without any flaws?
Oh, I think he definitely got to know him as a real person on many levels, at many level places in his life. I got to know him, but it's still in some sense, I know him as that person I knew before I was 11, and I know him as a character that I created on the page as best I could. I still don't know him as an adult man, and I've had the privilege of going and reading in Riverside, where I grew up, 3 times now this spring, and being in audiences that include my mother has been there, and many people who knew my father, and it's really interesting for them. You know, it's not that their idea of him conflicts with what I've said, but it adds to it and enriches it, and I get to have that experience as a result of the book being out and being read.
Mm-hmm. I know from writing my own book, I was surprised at how the learning continued long after the book was published, and it sounds like that's certainly happening for you. You're continuing to get to know your father and get to know yourself.
Absolutely, as a result of the story and the interaction with readers, you know, the book belongs to you, you think, while you're writing it, and as soon as it goes out into the world, it belongs to the readers, mm-hmm. and the impressions that they take from it and the lessons and the insights enrich my experience of the book. It's no longer mine. It's a communal experience.
Well said. Well, I did say that I was going to ask you about your writing life, and then I got back to wanting to know more of this story.
Oh, let's just meander around.
Okay. So you've been writing for how long now?
Well, I've been writing since I was a little kid, like so many people who love to write. I've been writing seriously for publication since I finished graduate school in 1996. So.
And how did you come to be a writer? You said you've been writing since you were a little kid, but that's different than being a writer. And how did you come to that path?
I always did as a little kid, as I said, and I had this privilege in second grade. My teacher let me sit in a beanbag chair and write a novel for 3 weeks. And after, you know, it's the height of my writing career so far, probably always. And then I went to school as an English major, and it turns out as an English major, you get to read lots of books and you get to discuss them, which is wonderful, but you're not really writing in the sense that I wanted to write. And so I left school with a kind of a lostness. That longing for writing that I'd always had just didn't seem to mesh with what I had experienced in college. And by happenstance, I stumbled into working for the National Park Service, living in these beautiful places, and what's my first instinct? I want to write about this. And I started trying to and realized all I was writing was it's a pretty place over and over again. And that's not dynamic and that's not alive. And I was really frustrated with myself. And so that's why I made the decision to go back, study creative writing in graduate school. I studied fiction writing. And that training was so invaluable to me because a short story or any piece of fiction has to have a plot, has to have momentum, has to have change, and all of these elements that so enriched when I went back and started writing those stories of working for the park and the Forest Service and living in Stehekin. It added that element of story to it, you know, of a plot line that people could follow, characters that people could you know, get close to and sympathetic to. And
so your formal education in fiction writing has served you well in your nonfiction writing. Both of your books that you've published so far are nonfiction, and I know you have essays published pretty extensively in a variety of publications.
Well, the personal, I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, the personal essay form seemed to, I did try writing fiction, of course, and was trained in writing fiction, but it always felt a little forced for me. It always felt a little difficult. And when I came back to the personal essay form, when I finally took a class in what they called creative nonfiction, I felt like my voice just came to life. This is what I wanted to write. I wanted to, you know, be in the real world and share real insights, but I had those tools to do it.
Okay. Yes, well, that was my question about. Is nonfiction always the form that you use in your writing?
It is most of the time. It turned out while I was writing Test Ride, it was so heavy and emotional, so personal to be dealing with issues of grief and the tragedies that the heroes and sheroes, as they call them, of the civil rights movement faced, that I needed a break. And so I returned to fiction writing, and I've been working a little bit on a young adult novel, which was my side project during Test Ride.
Oh, great. It's nice to have something to keep your creative juices going and yet have a break from something you're so immersed in.
Yeah, you and I have talked about that, how you know, it helps to be working on multiple projects at one time.
And you teach writing too, right?
I do. I teach writing, which comes with the wonderful fringe benefit of getting to read a lot of people's stories all the time, you know, which is enriching for me, I think, both in kind of a technical way, because you see how they put it together and the techniques they use and think about how the stories could be improved, and also just because you hear so many cool stories.
Yeah, right. Well, I've had the privilege of taking several classes and workshops with Anna Maria, and if any of our listeners are ever looking for a good writing teacher and a good writing class, I can highly recommend Anna Maria. And at the end of our time today, I'll have you give some information about how people can track you down in case they do want to do that sometime.
Terrific.
I know there's no one right way to write, but I'm always interested to talk with writers about their process. What's your writing process, or what's your writing life like?
I'm a morning writer. I'm almost completely unproductive after about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. So I get up, and before I start to write anything, I read something that I admire, because I find that what makes me want to write more than anything is reading great writing. So I pick something up, I read for a little while until I get in the mode, and then I sit down at my desk and I start reading whatever I was working on the day before. And one of two things happens. I may start reading it and think, this is the worst thing I've ever written in my life, and I need to throw it away right now. And if that happens, I give myself permission to close it before I hit delete and open something else and start looking at that and go through it. I read through it a few times and then move on, either move on from there, or if I'm later in the project, work on revision, work on places where I can open up the story, portals, I'll call them, where there's a way to go further, to describe more, to add a scene, and work through that. So it starts with reading other people's work, reading my own work, and then delving into the writing. I can usually write for 2 or 3 hours, and then I need to go split wood or do something physical for a little while, do the dishes, right, or vacuum. That's what all writers have to do, vacuum, right. And then I get back to it.
maybe all writers do have to vacuum, but I would venture to say that if you visited most of our homes, you might not really.
I didn't say we vacuumed well or often.
Well, if you've just joined us, I'm Iris Gravel, and I'm talking today with Anna Maria Spagna, author of Test Ride on the Sunnyland Bus, A Daughter's Civil Rights Journey. Anna Maria, could we hear another excerpt from Test Ride now?
Well, I'm gonna jump way ahead in the story, and I'm not giving away too much, I don't think, by addressing the question. One of the central questions that really, really bothered me on my whole journey was why my dad never talked about his involvement in the movement. He never told my mother. He never told his friends. I thought that perhaps he carried some guilt because he had jumped bail. I thought maybe he was disillusioned with the progress that's been made in that time. Certainly some of the other people I interviewed felt that way about the era. And I had been in touch with one of the men who rode the bus with him by the name of Johnny Herndon. Johnny's a black man and was very, very generous with his memories. And at this point in the story, I'm just looking for an excuse to call him back. I've really already been through the experience, done all my research. I just like him, and I want to call him. And I'm going to read the conversation and where it went from there, because it has to do with that question that haunted me. "And what exactly happened to you right after you got out of jail and dropped out of school?" He'd told me that his wife had been harassed and that her father had, but I still wasn't clear on what had happened specifically to him. I didn't want to open old wounds. I just wanted to understand. "You eventually found work, right?" I said. "Oh, not really. No one would hire me. That's why I went into business for myself." I'd known that Johnny had started a taxi business. "The taxi business?" "No. At first I did outside sales work for 8 or 10 years. What I did really was work out of town a lot in rural areas, and mostly black areas, so there'd be no trouble." "Wait a minute. Did you say you had to stay away from Tallahassee more or less for 8 or 10 years? "Oh, it was no big deal," he said. "What we did on the bus was something that had to be done, and we were glad to do it." I believed him. I believed in him, and I knew this was my chance. "Was it worth it? Are things really any better?" "You wouldn't believe the difference now." "What has changed, actually?" "The attitude of the people," he says. "Young people who can't remember just can't understand. People younger than maybe 40. Much more has been accomplished than I ever expected to see in my lifetime." Somewhere in the middle of the conversation, I realized I was having the conversation that I'd wanted to have with Leonard Speed, the one I'd wanted to have with my dad. About politics and life and the past and the future, about what matters. I didn't want to hang up, so I found myself stalling for time, trolling for a question to ask, and I came up with one. "Did you ever tell your kids about what you did?" "It's funny you ask, because with all this boycott anniversary stuff, they heard about it and said, 'We never heard about that.' They said, 'Dad, how come you never told us you did that?' And I told them, 'It was no big deal.' No big deal that he risked his life, lost his job, and dropped out of college with a term to go, then traveled away from his family for 8 or 10 years afterward. No big deal. I thought about that famous quote from War and Peace. It is only unselfconscious activity that bears fruit. And the man who plays a part in a historical drama never understands its true significance." Johnny Herndon's voice turned soft and earnest again. "See, that tells you something about your dad, too."
Thank you for sharing that part. And not only is it a moving exchange, but it's an example, I think, of your beautiful writing and some of the many layers, as I mentioned earlier, in this story. And I know there are other layers you haven't even touched on in our conversation yet. In that passage, he makes reference to this boycott anniversary stuff. What was that all about?
Well, it was many amazing coincidences happened on my journey. And one of them was that I was digging around in Tallahassee, and I had almost decided that there was no story here, that this was just a thread I'd followed to the dead end. And I ended up in the basement archives at Florida A&M University. They were actually closed for renovation, so I had snuck in past some sawhorses. And so a woman who was otherwise not too pleased to see me said when I asked her, do you know anything about the Tallahassee bus boycott? She said, have you seen this? And she pulled off of the wall a poorly photocopied flyer for the 50th anniversary celebration of the Tallahassee bus boycott. And here it was coming up in 4 months. I hadn't even done the math to figure out it had been exactly 50 years. And so I ended up attending the celebration. It was one of the most moving, if not the most moving experience of my life, week-long series of events where you would meet not one or two people, not just Johnny Herndon or John Folsom who rode the bus with my dad, but hundreds of people who had stories of courage and sacrifice during the years of the civil rights movement. There would be events where there would be, between, 100, 300, sometimes 500 black folks in attendance celebrating the boycott and the successes of it. And I thought that I would go as a spectator and maybe take notes. I might sometime write an article about it. And time and again, they would call me forward to be honored in my father's stead. So it was a very moving experience for me.
And I know from reading the book, it was moving for them as well to have you kind of standing in for your father and for them to be able to express to you their appreciation for what he had done, which I know also just gave you more of that picture of who he was and appreciating his courage. But it was something you gave to them as well by being there and really being him.
It felt like it was, and one of the beauties of writing this story, or really any story I think of historical consequence like this, is that you're tying those threads back together. You're bringing, I think that what was perhaps moving for them was just to see this part of their story that had been lost. They didn't know what had happened to my dad once he jumped bail and left town, and then to have it come back together and to make that story whole again was, I think, pretty rich for them, and certainly was for me.
Yeah. That's great. I wanted to talk a little more about your writing life, since you gave me permission to jump around a bit.
Meander. We're meandering.
What is the hardest thing you deal with in your writing?
Oh, that's a hard question. I think that for me, in the genre of creative nonfiction, and this comes up almost daily in my writing classes, is, what is the creative part, and where is that license acceptable, and where is it not acceptable? I read that section earlier where I was dramatizing a period in time, and when I sat down to write that first chapter, which I mentioned was so hard, I thought, I have notebooks and 1,000-page history. I have so much background. And the first sentence I went to go write was, it was a sunny Saturday in Florida. And I thought, I don't know if it was sunny or not. So I had to get on the phone to Johnny Herndon, and I said, was it sunny? And he said, oh, honey, it's Florida. I said, okay, it was sunny. Next sentence, they had lit cigarettes. I thought, oh, I don't know if they really did. So I had to call him. So that line between where is that okay? What if there wasn't a Johnny Herndon who I could call? Would it be okay to figure it's Florida and to say it's sunny? I would err on the side of saying that's okay to say it was sunny. But if I have the chance of finding out for real if it was, I want to follow. So that's a real challenge for me. There's also passages where I talk about what the bus driver may have been thinking. And I allowed myself that license to say what he may have been thinking, because it adds so much to the story. And how much do you hedge that? Do you say, I think he may have been? Do you just say he may have been? Do you say he was thinking? Mm-hmm. All of those decisions are, I think, really crucial in this form.
So that's where some of the work comes in, and making those decisions.
Right, and you can see how tedious they are. You're a writer as well. It's in the revision process. It's not in that first draft. It's when you go back and you look at how you phrase that. Did you say, I think he may have said? Did you say he may have thought? Did you say he did think? And which one do you want it to be? And all of those decisions are, and for me, it's joy. It's pleasure to do that work. But it is tedious, and it is, I think, that's what makes good writing good writing. It's some people, not usually writers, but have the idea that you just have this inspiration and that it all shows up on the page and it's just like that forever. And of course, it never is. It's revision is 95% of the work at minimum.
So you enjoy the revision process? Is that fair to say?
I adore the revision process. I struggle with composing. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I'm with you on that one, and I am often quite envious in my writing groups whenever we do some kind of a writing exercise, and it's a free write, and there are some people in my writing groups, including Lorna, who's here with us today, who it seems that the words just really flow so easily out of the pen on that, on those rough free writes, and it never comes, or hardly ever comes that way for me. But fortunately, I too adore the revision process, and my reward for struggling through those first rough drafts is I know I'll get to do what I really like, which is the crafting, the fine-tuning, the writing and rewriting.
Absolutely. I feel the same way. And I also came to realize more when writing this book than ever before in my writing that part of what makes that composing so difficult for me is it's an act of courage. You're laying yourself out there. And it's always going to be a lousy first draft, right? And you just have to give yourself that permission. And that takes plain guts. You know, courage takes a lot of form. And for a writer, it's just allowing that to come out however it comes out. And that is hard for me. I'm a perfectionist, and I would rather have it come out just right, and it's just not going to.
You do make references in several places in this book, Test Ride, about your own self-doubts and feelings of lack of courage, and I really appreciated the way you shared yourself in that very human way. You showed us you as a real person, and you have a nice self-effacing style and light humor. Sometimes at just the moment I felt as a reader I needed it to
lighten it.
Yeah,
sure.
Because it is many parts of the story are quite heavy, and there's also the difficult part of the story of your mother's illness with cancer. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you deal with that in this, or how that figures into this story about your dad's involvement in the civil rights movement?
Absolutely. There were at least two really major decisions for me in writing the book. When I first started writing it, I really thought it would be a history. And for once, after writing a book of personal essays, some of which leaned pretty heavily personal, I didn't want to expose myself that much again. I wanted to write about someone else and another time period and these other characters. And I started writing this book that way and realized that for many reasons, memoir made more sense. One being that as a young person, my wonder and awe at it all could come through if I had that eye, if I had my own journey as part of it. Also, I heard conflicting stories from other people in that era, and so I wanted to give voice to them. So deciding for it to be a memoir was one very hard decision. And the second one was that right in the middle of writing it, as you know from reading it, my mom was diagnosed with what we assumed was terminal cancer. Everyone suggested that that's what it was, and I was the caretaker. I was sitting by her bedside doing all this research, and I started to have a real ethical dilemma over this, that I'm making such a hero out of my father for something he did on one day in 1957 when he was 25 years old, and here's my mother who raised three kids alone and earned her PhD in that time and did all these amazing, courageous things and was now battling cancer with immense courage and grace and integrity. And who's the hero in the story? They both had to be the heroes in the story. And so now I had a third plot line that I would have to braid in, not just the history but and my own story, but the story of my mother and her struggle with cancer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you did braid those stories in beautifully, and I think people who haven't read the book yet will really appreciate the beautiful, skillful writing, as well as these very moving and inspiring stories. I know that you're in the midst of a book tour for Test Ride. You've left remote Stehekin, and you've been on the road for a little while. I also know you're teaching, but what are you writing now? Are you getting a chance to to do some writing, or have you put something on the back burner?
I almost have no time for writing right this minute, which is unfortunate. I've been traveling now for 6 weeks straight, and I haven't had the time to write. But I do have another book of essays coming out in the spring from Oregon State University Press. It's similar to Now Go Home in that it covers life in Stehekin, but it focuses more closely on the idea of community and how communities come together and how they work together. And I've been somewhat hesitant even to use the word community because it can be over-idealized, and no community is as ideal as we'd like it to be. But so I'm working on doing final edits on that book so that it can come out in spring.
Spring of 2011.
Thank you. It is spring now. Yeah, spring of 2011 is when that book will come out. So crafting those essays, and then I'm always working on new essays for small journals, for High Country News or Mountain Gazette or Orion, different venues that appreciate sort of the environmental nature-y side of my writing. So I'm always doing that kind of work.
Great. What's the title of the new book?
Well, that's one of the problems. The book's working title is Where You Find It. Where You Find It.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll have to... I'm making a note of that, and we'll have to
We'll keep take suggestions from listeners.
That.
Yeah.
So who do you like to read? You know, the classic advice for if you want to be a good writer is to read a lot. Who do you like to read?
Well, I read very, very broadly. And especially when I was in high school and in college, I loved woman writers. I was moved by Virginia Woolf and by Alice Walker, and Anne Sexton's poetry really influenced me. And then, interestingly, when I moved into the woods and I was looking for writers doing the kind of writing that I wanted to do, they were almost all men. You know, so I read, you know, Wendell Berry and Rick Bass and Barry Lopez and John McPhee and Edward Abbey and go on and on. And, of course, there were a few when I was first starting to read. Gretel Ehrlich was writing, and there's Mary Austin from California who are nature writers, but there weren't a lot. And so I could almost tell that my writing voice started taking on that sort of a masculine quality, I think. And partially that was you're working on a trail crew, which is kind of manly man work, unfortunately, and even though many, many women do it. And then as I started working in creative nonfiction and working in essay, I went out more broadly. I adore James Baldwin's essays and Joan Didion's essays. I love Bernard Cooper and Brian Doyle, who's down in Portland at Portland Magazine. There are so many wonderful, wonderful essayists, both men and women, that are, and I love the humorists. I love Sarah Vowell and David Sedaris, of course, and I read a lot of creative nonfiction.
Well, if anyone is listening to this on a podcast and they have the opportunity to stop the recording and jot down some of those names, you've just rattled off quite a extensive and strong reading list for anyone. So I appreciate you sharing that, and it is another one of the joys of taking a writing workshop or class with you, is that that is something I've found you do as a teacher, too, is to direct people to those examples of really fine writing and fine writers.
And I did forget to mention Iris Grabel as well, so
oh.
Yeah.
Thank you. clearly you've been inspired a lot by your mother and your father, who you came to know much better after he died. Who or what else has inspired you, either as a writer or, well, I guess mostly as a writer? If you can't, you probably can't really separate that out from who's inspired you in your life.
But. Right, and of course, we could just do a list for the last 20 minutes of our discussion of people who have inspired me. But because you mentioned people, I did want to mention Congressman John Lewis, who plays a role in the book. I did meet him at the 50th anniversary boycott. But reading his stories of courage in the civil rights movement early on, I mean, what he persevered through, he was... arrested more than 40 times before he was 24 years old. He was beaten unconscious several times, beaten many times, and to come through with a kind of hope and stalwart faith in the forward progress of mankind, what he calls the community of the beloved community, which crosses all boundaries, which doesn't just mean blacks and whites, but it means immigrants and non-immigrants and gays and non-gays and the whole broad spectrum. And that principled way of living a life and the kind of courage that and integrity that the man has is a great example to me, not something I feel that I'm quite living up to, but something I would certainly aspire to live up to, and someone I admire very much. I also admire writers for their dedication. I admire all writers for their dedication, published and unpublished. Anybody who has the guts to pick up a pen and put things on the page inspires me, and that's part of why I enjoy teaching, because you see that courage coming up over and over again, that people are giving it a go and putting themselves out there, whether it's fiction or poetry or nonfiction. You're taking a chunk of yourself and putting it on the page, and I'm inspired by that daily.
Yes, that is true. People who've never tried writing possibly can't appreciate just how demanding that craft is, and there is a lot of inspiration from knowing that there are a lot of people out there who are doing that every day. Well, Ana Maria, listeners on Lopez can buy your book from our own independent bookstore here, our local independent bookstore, Isle Haven Books. But there may be some people listening who aren't anywhere near Isle Haven Books or Lopez Island, or they'll just want to find out some more about you. So how can people find out more about you, your writing? And if they can't get to Isle Haven Books, how can they get copies of Test Ride on the Sunnyland Bus?
Well, you can pick up Test Ride at any independent bookstore. You can order it there. Also directly from the University of Nebraska Press, who put it out. They have a website. I have my own website, AnnaMariaSpagna.com. Spagna is S-P-A-G-N-A. It looks like Spagna. So. And I have a Facebook page as well, so you can find out information about the book. And also about, I usually post links to my most recent essays when they come out so that folks can follow the writing that way. I'm teaching right now for Gotham Writers Workshop online. I teach memoir writing, usually advanced classes, but occasionally the beginning class as well. And I've just begun working with Would-Be Writers MFA program, which is a low residence MFA program. Such an amazingly supportive group of people. I wasn't even sure I was ready to take on that kind of responsibility, but it's been terrific to work with them. And they have a website as well. So.
Right. Some listeners will know that my family and I lived in Stehekin for a couple of years in the early 90s when, there still aren't telephones in Stehekin, or at least not as of today, are there?
I think that Skype has changed things a little bit, although the upload speeds are awfully slow. So yeah, right. It's quite isolated.
But back then in the mid-90s, there was no telephone, and people didn't have, I mean, the internet in the early 90s and email was just really coming into use in the downlake world, as we called it. But now, the internet and email access is in Stehekin, and so.
And it changed my life radically, as you can imagine. When my partner Lori and I first went to Stehekin in 1990, and I started working seasonally, we bought property in 1998, so we've been there year-round for 12 years. And even at that point, when we made that step of settling there, buying the property and building a home, I assumed I'd be doing physical labor until I couldn't do it any longer, and which wasn't daunting to me. I could do a little writing in the off-season. But once the internet came in, there were other opportunities for me to do the teaching online, to branch out, and I ended up giving up trail work in 2004, which I never would have expected was a direction my life could have gone.
Right. Speaking of those sideways paths
exactly,
that you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. You never could have known.
Your first book, and it sounds like your next book, published by Oregon State University Press, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Test Ride was published by University of Nebraska, is that right?
That's correct.
So tell us a little bit about how you found them to be your publisher, and did you have an agent, or That's the process for people, writers who want to be published, that is often quite daunting.
It was a lengthy process for me, as it is for so many writers. I had an agent for Now Go Home who shopped the book in New York with commercial publishers, and they were very hesitant to take on a regional title like that, what they saw as regional. It just that the crosscut size in the title made it regional. And so the agent very graciously, after trying pretty hard to get it published, just kicked it back to me. It's not worth it to an agent to sell a book to a small press like a university press. They won't make enough of enough money off of it. And so at that point, I took the book back and I sent it out to 5 university presses, and OSU Press picked it up. They were wonderful to work with. There are only 4 or 5 full-time employees with the press. It was like having a family do your book. They asked me about every detail, about the cover I would like to see, the kind of page quality I would like to see. We discussed everything along the way, and they helped immensely with promoting it in the region. They had all those connections. But it wasn't going to be a national book in any sense. And I really wanted Test Ride to be a national book. I feel like the story is a story for all Americans. So again, I started with a new agent who shopped it around. The problem with marketing this book wasn't so much the story, but the form. One of the questions once it would get through to publishers was, which shelf will it go on? Mm-hmm. Is it a memoir? Is it a history? Is it a biography? And when you say it's all of them, they say, we can't do anything with that. So I was quite discouraged after a year of that, and I had by happenstance sent off the manuscript to the River Teeth Literary Nonfiction Prize, which is one of a handful of creative nonfiction book-length prizes in the country. Forgot completely about it, and had an agent get in touch with me who said, "If you make it a straight story, if you make it just the history, I think I can sell it." And so I doggedly sat at my desk and trimmed away a good third of it, got it down to a streamlined story, and when that was just about to go on the street to the commercial publishers when I got the call from River Teeth that I had won the contest, and I said, well, which book do you want? And they said, we want the one we read, which was the longer, more complicated tale. So almost despite myself, the book that I intended to come out, the book that I love the best and what means the most to me, came out. And Nebraska is just who publishes the winner of that contest. Nebraska is a much bigger press, has longer tentacles to reach larger audiences, and they've been terrific to work with, but of course it's not the same as a small Northwest family working with your book. So it's been a different experience for me, but very exciting.
Oh. Well, congratulations again. They chose well.
Oh, thank you very much. And if there's a lesson for writers who may be listening, it's simply persistence. Mm-hmm. It's the only answer there is in trying to get your work out to the public. I mean, we have more venues now because we have blogging, which is, of course, a way to get your work out to many writers that wasn't available or respected as much, even just a few years back. Mm-hmm. So we do have that. And, of course, all the small literary magazines and the commercial magazines. But all of those, it all takes persistence.
Right. And courage.
And courage. It's a story of courage.
Right. Well, you've been listening to Lopez Writers Read on KLOI FM 102.9 and a conversation with Stehekin, Washington writer Anna Maria Spagna about her writing and her new book, Test Ride on the Sunnyland Bus. It's been a real pleasure to have you visit us here on Lopez, Anna Maria.
Thank you very much. It's just such a delight to be here, to see this place, this beautiful home that you have, and to talk with you, Iris, about writing, which I know you are as passionate about as I am. So thanks.
That's right. It's been fun for both of us.
Great.
You can read the work of Lopez writers at Shark Reef, the online literary magazine of the Lopez Writers Guild, by going to sharkreef.org. That's sharkreef, all one word, .org. Earlier interviews for this program have been archived to KLOI's website. Go to kloi.org and click on Archives. This program is being pre-recorded. Thank you so much for joining us.